What's on the table is the problem of two black holes. And so even though this is a very small word up in the corner, colliding black holes, you're to understand that as a phrase at the end of every single one of these questions. When I say, which is a better way to proceed, what I mean is, for the colliding black hole problem. Okay, I just left it off because it was repetitious, but that's the fundamental orientation we have here. So let's just run down the questions. And again, just like Karsten's taxonomy, you're welcome to add questions or to object. You can even object to questions if you want to, but I'll try to defend my questions. Seems to be one big question on the table. What is the better way to proceed? Avoid singularities in our slices and accept the long neck inside the black hole, that is to accept grid sucking, or to excise the black holes. We've heard a substantial amount of progress on excision at this conference, and I'm not even going to attempt to summarize that right now, but I just want to get the question on the table. Yeah?
Is grid sucking something that everybody knows what it is?
Oh, I didn't know there were two. What are they?
I mean, one I would say is that grids fall into the black hole, and the other one would be the grid stretching, the distortion.
Well, they tend to go together, right?
That's the important one.
Yeah.
The second one.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's right.
That's
right. Yeah. 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 The picture I have in mind that goes with this is to draw the singularity in sort of a space-time diagram. Like, I know that's not the causal structure, but this is the picture that helps one think about it. And then when it has a slice at late times, it's going like this, and at even later times, it goes like this, and it's forced to have a long neck because it is avoiding the singularity. And so one gets many grid points and grid stretching in this long neck.
Again,
yes, Helmut. I must say I don't completely understand the last talk. I want to understand it because it's a very interesting proposal. I want to understand what's going on in detail there. Yet. Beverly.
Yeah, it's sort of an outsider on this.
Me too.
I'm wondering the following question. I mean, it would be sort of nice if some of the excellent mathematicians in the room came up with a prescription that says, this is it. This is the magic Lapson shift that's going to solve all these problems, no matter what system you're looking at. But I don't think that's going to happen. And I think that a lot of empirical work is going to have to be done.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is it, there's two things. Is it clear, or is it possible, let's be optimistic, is it possible to find a system other than doing the whole problem that you're trying to do where you could distinguish which were better choices? Now, some of that's been done, so some choices are obviously not good. But is there a problem where you can do lots of runs very quickly to test among different proposals? And then, can you isolate the coordinates? Can you tell the difference? Because if your code is going bad because of some difference in problem, then no shift will be occurred. So the idea would be, what are good test problems where you can control everything else and in some reasonable span of time test the variety of coordinate conditions and have some confidence that it might be relevant to the problem you want to do?
Yeah, for instance, yeah.
Your question seems to assume that there'll be, one or a couple of coordinate conditions practice, and that, will be generally better for all two black hole problems. And I think it's much more likely that, one particular choice will work well in one very specific situation and work horribly in some other very specific situations.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I'm an outsider in the black hole community, and I want to say it seems to me it'd be very good for the community to agree on a path of progress in the way that Bernie was talking about, and that'll sort of naturally lead us into some particular problems, and that'll lead us into some particular way of attacking those particular. Yes.
And an outsider, especially somebody who doesn't mix well with the
computers. The thing that's frustrating about this kind of thing is to know what we should look for. Should we look for parabolic equations, look for elliptic equations,
yeah.
look for ways of approximating solutions, find algorithms, find solutions of nonlinear elliptic equations via a sequence of linear equations, or what? What I've often been told is, well, if you want to know what's going to help the numerical people, go do it yourself. But for some of us, that's not such an easy thing to do. So, but maybe you just don't need the help of that people like me. I don't know. So I guess I'm just laying that question out. Is there some way for mathematical people to know how to help?
Well, he's holding, Mark's holding something in his hand that I think is the response to. Yeah. Yeah, good. Yeah, you know. Good. Yeah.
More analytic people in the room might be able to do that would help us greatly.
Excellent. Okay. Let me go quickly through my list of questions because they're about half on the floor already. Yes, Alan. Sure. Yes. 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 Yes.
I've known for a long time what grid stretching is, and grid stretching I have for the first time this week. My question is, are they the same or are they not? From what I've said, I wasn't clear.
I think grid stretching is more of the usual problem where you actually get unbounded loads and a metric function to compensate for trying to set the singularity. Grid stretching. It's not only it's related, but it's where you're not using any kind of shift condition which will hold your grid point out right until they just fall in, and that's grid stretching. And typically, you don't get unbounded growth in your metric function there, but you lose resolution. You don't call your grid down in time. Why?
Or can you just throw in some extra meshes?
There are all kinds of
options,
but it's just one of your general problems.
Okay, let me run down the list of questions and we'll get to the meaty discussion. Are elliptic solvers practical now? Us theorists, we love elliptic solvers for various purposes, but we understand they're very costly. And we'd like to know, numerically, would you rather avoid elliptic equations entirely, or you would? Yeah. Okay, that's, yeah. Yes. You bet. I'm coming to that. You bet. On the other hand, we have the hyperbolic schemes, which I must say seem very attractive to me. What are the actual advantages in use, and what are the disadvantages? And we'll be coming back to that. So don't start to answer the question now, but I just want to raise the question. And Vince and, let's see, is it Vince and Lars have been working on harmonic spatial coordinates, which I guess Carson already mentioned. We'll hear a contribution on that later. So let me not go into detail on that, but just let me raise it as a possible way to go. This will be my second and last list of questions. Outgoing wave boundary conditions. What will suffice to solve the two black hole problem in its initial stages, and then later on in 10 years when we're really doing a wonderful job and doing major case studies on different parameters and following it late in time and everything? Can we get away with just a simple time-like boundary for which now there is a good theoretical analysis that we've heard about? Should we match to outgoing null slices at some particular radius? Or should we just go all the way to scribe plus, as we heard about in the last talk? I don't know the answer to that, but these are interesting possibilities. A lot of us considered that algebraic gauges were just dead, but they keep coming back, and there may be some life left in the old things. Now, as far as harmonic time coordinate, if you really mean box t equals 0 for your time coordinate, I think I really have to beat up on that. We need some more theoretical work on this issue, but Bob and I talked about this a little bit on the occasion of a Grand Challenge meeting a couple of years ago, and we should have written that up, but we never did. Anyway, Bob was able to invent a method of creating counterexamples very quickly to any conjecture you'd like to make. Remember, the first job of a time coordinate is to remain timelike. If it doesn't remain timelike, it has serious trouble. And what we'd like is some kind of general theorem that says, under thus and so initial conditions on t and its normal derivative to the time to the initial slice, box t will remain a time-like function forever. And we don't think there's any such theorem. It's a very tricky business. Charlie, do you, Alan, do you know? Yes. Oh yes. Yeah. And Vince reminded me of that too when we were talking about. I think it was Vince. But yes, that's absolutely right. But that's the only case I know where there seems to be behavior like that, or whether there's any fairly general theoretical reason for believing the time-like harmonic coordinate remains good. I have a horrible feeling that aside from situations like that, in general, it's really quite ill-behaved. But I think this is a question that I think theorists can pose back for theorists. I think we need theorems about this. We need theorems or counterexamples.
Regarding whether they stay time-like,
yeah. Now, if we heard...
space-like?
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's what I mean. I mean, it's a time function in the sense of Hawking. Yeah. You bet. It's very hard to keep it from trying to do that. On the other hand, there are generalizations, as we heard about, for instance, from Jimmy, box T equals F. And then the challenge is to how do you invent F to keep T a time function? Okay, let me run right along. I'm almost done. If we excise black holes, if we follow the excision route, for elliptic schemes, we've got to put boundary conditions at the excision surface. How do we do that? In fact, how do we choose the excision surface in the first place? I mean, the idea of using the apparent horizon as an excision surface has been around for a very long time. I believe Bill invented it, but I'm not even sure about the ancient history. It's been around for a very long time, and Bill has been pushing it for a long time. We need some more theoretical analysis on that subject, and I've actually written one particular paper where I worked through one particular scheme for doing that, and it actually looks promising as far as I got, but it gets awfully complicated. We need more theoretical thought on that. And on the other hand, in purely hyperbolic schemes, there's the very tempting prospect that if we can just let everything fall down the black hole, coordinates, mesh points, everything, and just say goodbye to them as they go, and we never have to put a boundary condition there. Now, that's an enticing prospect. Can we really deliver on that? Certainly, in some sense, theoretically, that is a perfectly valid way to proceed. You can just forget about some of your domain of dependence. But can we do that numerically? Can we write a code that actually does that and works? I don't know the answer. You guys are working up to it, but I think it's still an open question. There may be some boundary conditions necessary at the excision surface. Okay, that's my list of questions. Before getting off, let me just ask, does anybody else have any questions that they think ought to be on this list? If not, you know, ample time later to add questions.
It would be nice if we gave condition for certain physical properties that are desirable. For instance, that when one smashes two black holes, the end object is something one can recognize.
Yeah, that was actually on Carson's list, I guess. Yeah. So that's... Well, we'll fix the view graph before we scan it. Yes.
So I guess one question I have is, I mean, general relativity is so nice because it's coordinate invariant. You know, you can make all these coordinate transformations.
Yeah.
And yet, almost all the numerical schemes like to set up some coordinate system and then just stick with that through hell and high water.
Yeah.
One would like to think that in the numerical scheme, where it's the same kind of thing as one that does an analytic, your coordinates start running into trouble, and you just go ahead and you choose another coordinate system. Now, I understand that can be a little bit messy to code in the first instance, but is there some way in which one can do that? One can implement schemes like that where you change coordinate systems as the problem requires it?
Well, I think we need some guidance on how to do that.
There is some choice of left and shift which corresponds to changing the coordinates.
No, but one can do topologically distinct coordinate transformations. I mean, change the complete topology, let's say, from spherically symmetric type coordinates to rectangular coordinates. And that's not something that a lapse or a shift function is going to do for you without producing severe grid stretching and so forth.
Yeah. Well,
but, I mean, being willing to change the complete topology of one's grid function.
Yeah.
Grid,
yeah.
Pardon?
more like some adaptive distraction.
Yeah.
Right.
If I use the Samana image, I mean, it's a game to make the survival bomb, but I still believe it's a tool for others.
Hmm. Yeah.
So this is something that they can really do.
Let's put that on the fly. You choose the once and for all of any random revolution, if it doesn't work, you choose the different.
Well, you know, he has these steering functions here. He can steer the evolution of the coordinates.
Something else, under gate suspension, I do not mean necessarily something which is the backup.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
In any team, you have four functions free. Oh,
yes.
Anything that you have written down on one of the previous experiments, you just neglected these three factors.
Well, yes.
In some cases, there are problems with the numeric.
Yeah.
In some cases, it seems to work. This is a different issue. But in principle, I mean, you could always try the handle and see how you change it, how things develop, and maybe how you have changed the development.
Yes, that's quite right. I think if a theorist can give some guidance on good ways of steering the coordinates, I think that'll probably help the numerics. I think we need to say something more helpful than, well, if it crashes, just run back and try it again and using a different gauge. You know, that's not very helpful, right?
Related to this, and something I raised in one of the earlier statements was how do we diagnose what's going on in a given coordinate? How do we know we're approaching these are, I think, some deep issues that are well worthy of.
Okay, I think I'll get out of the way at this point and try to,
if one wants to analyze those questions, one has to really ensure that all the other things work. In the sense, I think you cannot go ahead and have an equation in the interior for which you don't know whether the discretization is stable.
And then also do some
gauge conditions for which you even don't know what system you get then, and then wandering around and not knowing what is causing the trouble. So I think what you have to do is you have to say, for example, I take hyperbolic equations and I take a fixed gauge and then I try to fix my boundary. And then I know that the boundary is working and then I can go ahead and now try to change the way I
All these questions interact with each other more or less strongly, and furthermore, they interact with other questions that are not on this list, mostly because we're theorists, not numericists. Right. Why don't we move along? Let's see. How about you? Yeah, good. Okay, why don't you go next? And then I'd really like to hear what Mark and the others have to say on their list of what the numericists thinks the theorists ought to be thinking about. I think that'd be great. So why don't we do it in that order?